Malcolm had a lot of influences on black people, but he also had some influence on white people. What do you attribute that to?
Well, Malcolm went around. He loved the platform. Malcolm loved the platform. Mm-hmm. And so again, when we're dealing with controls and the medium of telecommunication and media would have to go on these quote unquote white owned platforms. Because back then we had more as black people, we had more radio shows and newspapers than we do now. Mm-hmm. And so he would obviously do the Chitlin circuits, what they call it, absolutely deal with his own people. But he also wanted that message to be given to the dominant society because he knew how important it was for a black man to stand face to face with the white man and tell them what it is. It was important that black people saw that. And it was important that white folks knew that the Negro was dead. He wanted to put the image out that the Negro was dead and that the king had returned. So when he delivered this message, and he could taper his message to whites, especially white youths.
Right.
He's talking about an exploitive society, exploitive, unjust society that affects you as well. So he would talk to the high on the hog white, or the bottom of the barrel white, because there's a bottom of the barrel white as well, because you're dealing with a system of capitalism, right? We know that people who voted for Trump had holes in their roofs and said plainly to anybody that would listen, I know I'm not going to benefit from Trump being elected. He's going to make my life worse, actually, but I don't care because we have the same psychology. We have the same belief system. So I'm going to align myself with him because he sounds like me, and I sound like the president. Yes, I'll vote that person in. But Malcolm is like, well, you don't deserve to live in a house with a hole in it. You deserve that as a human being. That's not a human existence. You know, why do you want to have this superficial dominance over people you rarely even see? Most white people live in areas that there's no black people. So you become the black white people. And he starts ringing in their mind, in their head. They say, well, everybody wants to say, well, during his time and dealing with segregation and integration, and he was doing all these interviews, and all these people were saying, hey, we want integration. I think most people want integration. He's like, well, we'll call you on it. If everybody wants integration, y'all keep telling me about all these white folks that want integration, well, then why don't we have it? And what does integration look like? Mm-hmm. Right? Because you keep telling me about a social integration. You getting along with me has no bearing on my people, right? I'm looking at where they're living at, sir, ma'am. I'm looking at where they're living at. That's not integration. I see where you live. You live in a house with six doors or six rooms and land, acres of land. My people are stacked on top of each other with the resources ripped out, with the businesses gone, and one pair of shoes between six kids. No, that's not a human existence. That's not right. And y'all will allow children to live that way because you have created a society that looks at black children that they're not children. They're foreign entities that you shouldn't care about. Negroes, Necro, zombies, dead. They're supposed to live like that. They're cursed in some religions. So this is the society you created. This is the mindset that you create. Is this really fair? Is this really right? You have to ask yourself that. And they challenge the white man. And he challenges people, and he mostly challenges the children. You go to youth because you are the future leaders. When he went to Harvard and Yale and all these schools, he was a felon, never finished school. Mm-hmm. Why do you allow someone that's black, who's a nationalist, who's an internationalist, pan-Africanist, come in front of your students, you know, white children, and speak? And it had to be affected some? I'm sure. I'm sure he affected some that try to make some type of change or adjustment and where they fit, if they are business owners, and maybe they make sure that their employeeship is majority black, and that's their way of giving back. I'm sure that that's the case. But unfortunately, we need more. And I'm sure our people appreciate that being done, but it's still slave masterish, right? Because if the people were cold, if the slaves were cold on the outside, and they wanted better working, and he wanted them to work harder, if they were freezing with no clothes, it would hurt him. So what do? You give them clothing. And so they're warmer, so they work harder, and the production increases, right? But we can be confused and think that's a good person as a person that's doing a thing for himself, long-term legitimacy for his business, right? We get those things confused. And so that's one thing we have to do in terms of our political education. as a white man giving us clothes so that we are warmer, so that we can heighten the production in the cotton fields and make him richer. If we don't have any clothes on and we're cold, the production is going to decrease. He's going to lose business. So instead of coming out there whipping us, he gives us clothes. You see? Mm. See the difference? Yep. You know what I mean? So those are the things that we have to, and that's perspectives that Malcolm gave as well.
Mm. And brother, just one last question I want to ask you. And you could sum everything up. Looking at today's struggle, the Black Lives Matter, we're in the COVID situation. We've just seen what happened at the White House where, you know, the Proud Boys and stormed the Capitol. And they said there had been black people, we would have been laying in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I have is, what are some of Malcolm's views and thoughts that can be applied in today's freedom struggle?
Well, I mean, if we're wide-eyed, all of it.
Oh.
You know, all the things that he's ever said can be applied to the struggle now. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, with the creation of Black Lives Matter has become a more inclusionary, more intersectional, more diverse, all things that stymie and undercut the black liberation struggle. Those terms aren't used anymore. They're old terms, but they still apply today because they're still needed. If we can't clothe ourselves, if we can't feed ourselves, and we don't have housing, we have medical care, so on and so forth, we still have the same things we didn't have in the 60s. And we have more actual communities in the 60s than we do now. So we don't have those things in the 60s, and we don't have them now. But we're in the streets and we're raising our fists together. That's symbolic. With the advent of social media and the advent, the explosion of media and the interpretations of working together, it looks great, right? Because it looks like there is a coming together. But the mediums of control, the institutions of control, the farmland that delineates the food, what chemicals are put on the food. The job markets, when you go into any city and you look at these skyscrapers, who owns these skyscrapers? You know? And what is the racial makeup of the employership in these skyscrapers? Big business and industry, are we still a consumer race? You see? Do we have factories so that it's the lifeblood? When you remember in Detroit and Ford, that was the Ford Foundation. Ford is one of the people that sit at the table. Of course he's going to close these factories down and never replace them, so black people are in desolation there in Detroit for the last 70 years. But if we create factories, we make sure that whatever we're making in those factories, those people that are working there always have a job. They become the lifeblood of the community, and that is there, and the community will never die. So you don't have the drugs, you don't have the lawlessness, you don't have the gangs, you know, you don't have the carjackings, but all the things that were going on during that time up until now is eliminated because we have big business in industry. We have boats to take food from one continent to the next, you see. So when you're dealing with the Black Lives Matter movement, it's really about protest. It's really about young people getting involved, yes, but if I see them, I'm going to grab them, and I'm going to tell them the truth. Because the establishment, J. Edgar Hoover said this: you want to prevent the rise of a black Messiah. Malcolm was a Messiah. King was a Messiah. Mr. Farrakhan, Elijah Muhammad, they had these names and documents. Stokely Carmichael, they had these names and documents that could possibly be black Messiahs. They pretty much eliminated them all, save for Farrakhan. But Malcolm, they eliminated Malcolm. And so they said, the next time a Messiah arises, we're going to create him. And so you get to Al Sharpton, you get to Jesse Jackson. So internationalism is out the book. Okay, getting a ship or owning ships like Marcus Garvey wanted to do, so that you can have international trade. That if people want to go on vacation, you have an economic base where you have black people who are from this continent going to visit people on the other continent, and that we have a mixing of the jobs, right? You pick a nation of Ghana or Chad or Nigeria, and you say, hey, and this boat, half of y'all are going to work on this side, or half of y'all are going to work here, we're intermingled with one another, but there's going to be an economic base between the two of us. You see, that's real power. Raising your fist in the hand with a bandana around it that's red, white, and blue, or pink and yellow, or whatever it is that they're wearing out there, and that denigrates them. But the education apparatus isn't there because we're not dealing with the institutions. We're not dealing with power. We're not dealing with railroads. We're not dealing with trains. We're not dealing with airplanes. We're not dealing with gas. The gas comes from our nations, right? They come from our nations. They come from the darker nations of the world, right? But we don't get a penny from any of the gas sales. Right? We just buy gas. So until that is influenced or infused into the discussion, which Malcolm was maturing into, he was maturing into, was about legislation and law and educating our people. But he started to get actual institutions established. Muslim Mosque Incorporated was an institution that he was establishing through religion and through the Islamic world in Africa. And he was going to politicize the Muslim world, now connecting the Muslims globally now with the liberation struggle. If you look at them now, they want nothing to do with blacks that are in the streets, in the grassroots, or in the struggle. But he was going to infuse those two. And then you got African presidents, so now you got wealth. So whatever monies we need is away from the American government. We're not dependent on the American government. We're dependent on our homeland to do for us. Now what they're doing with their own people when they come here and they establish businesses in our community. So, you know, these are the things that our people need to know. And I'm sure that if Malcolm had 2 or 3 hours a day with him, what he gladly would have done, he would give him this type of game and this type of understanding.
Okay. Okay, Brother X, I want to thank you for this interview, and you done gave us a lot to think about this weekend of Malcolm X's death. And I hope to get you back for other interviews about Malcolm, because I'm sure there's still a lot that people don't know about Malcolm's views and thoughts. Thank you again, Brother X.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.